welcome to the Doc Arena podcast in association with Film Ireland. My name is Ross Whittaker, and every fortnight or so, I talk to documentary filmmakers about their films, both in terms of the subjects they choose and the way in which they fund, craft, and distribute their work. In this episode, I discuss One Night in Mill Street with director Andrew Gallimore. The film tells the incredible story of the Steve Collins versus Chris Eubank 1993 boxing fight that strangely took place in the rural town of Mill Street in County Cork, Ireland. The film charts the extraordinary build-up to the bout, which world champion Eubank was expected to win pretty easily, and how Collins upset the champ with costumes, comments, and a mental guru called Tony Quinn. One Night in Mill Street takes viewers back to the quirkiness of pre-Celtic Tiger Ireland, and it's a very enjoyable journey indeed. Andrew Gallimore, thanks a million for joining me. Can you start off by telling people what exactly this film is?
Yeah, sure, and thanks for having me. Yeah, the film, it's really very simple. It's just about 6 or 7 weeks leading up to a boxing match, the Chris Eubank, Steve Collins boxing match. We limited it very much to that sort of time period. And yeah, it's essentially just reassembling the cast of characters that made that event back in Mill Street back in 95.
What is it that brought you to that particular story? I feel like I did hear a while ago, you know, maybe quite a number of years ago, it was something that you were interested in. What brought you to it and made you stick with it?
Yeah, well, the producer, Morgan Bush, and myself had this idea many, many years ago to do a trilogy of three docs on three separate fights that we thought were very useful in terms of almost encapsulating a little bit of sort of 20th century Ireland. So the first one was A Bloody Canvas, which was a Civil War doc in many respects. It's about a fight that happened in Sackville Street, as it was then. And then the second one was McGuigan Pedrosa, which was kind of our Troubles doc, if you like. And this is our Celtic Tiger fight, Collins Eubank.
You didn't get to make them all in one go, though.
We certainly didn't. There was about a 15-year gap, I think, between them. We certainly feel 15 years older anyway than we did when we started.
What made you stick with it then? I guess if you started 15 years ago, there must have been a few disappointments along the way. Was it difficult to get it made?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, the first thing is clearly fight footage and rights. You know, getting the rights to a black and white film shot in 1923 isn't a problem. So the first installment was pretty straightforward. This one was more complicated just because the rights now surrounding boxing, particularly in that early kind of time. I mean, 95 was that real transition time between the time when sort of primetime boxing left terrestrial television in the UK and found itself on Sky. And it's really interesting that they're not a huge amount, I think, of concern was given in those days to residual archive rights. It was really about the live event and selling satellite dishes and all this. So unraveling who owned what, that actually was what delayed this one, plus a bit of COVID thrown in as well. But yeah, I mean, this took 5 years, really, from where to go.
Yeah, wow. And I mean, I think, who owned the rights in the end? Because I guess nowadays, I think, you know, a boxer will probably have non-exclusive rights to their fights maybe a year after the fight has happened. You know, once the broadcast is well done and dusted, the promoter would have non-exclusive rights. But it's probably maybe in more recent history, those rights are more clearly defined. Who owned the rights in the end? Was it the promoter Barry Hearn, or where did it lie?
It's kind of partly between Hearn and Eubank himself. He had to sign off. And, you know, this was the interesting thing about this film, really, was the fact that, you know, there's the old cliche, you know, it's a war thing, that history is written by the victors. And of course, in this case, history was kind of owned by the vanquished. And I suppose that really was the issue. But he was great. I mean, you know, he agreed, you know, to cut a deal for the rights to the archive and to give what was indeed, I thought, quite a sort of a gracious interview, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think his contribution, Chris Eubank, what an interesting character you have in your hands, which is probably one of the things that attracted you to the story. There's quite a number of interesting characters in and around this particular fight, but he gives an incredible performance in your interview. I mean, he's really, you know, magnetic and kind of electric to watch. And as you say, he's the vanquished. So it feels like maybe it could be the kind of situation where someone would say, no, I don't want to do this. And what was the process, I suppose, of getting someone like Chris Eubank to agree to access and do the interview for the documentary?
I mean, you know, the nuts and bolts of it and the phone calls and the agents and all this sort of stuff, that mercifully is a job for the producers. But I think in terms of the interview itself, though, I just got the impression that he was kind of quite intrigued by the request to actually talk about a fight that he lost. And certainly in terms of the day itself, I remember it really clearly. I think it's the first time it's ever occurred to me that about halfway through the interview, and we stopped for just a coffee or some water or something, that I sort of walked away from the seat thinking, this documentary has completely changed from what I had in mind some 35 minutes earlier. I was sitting in the chair and obviously concentrating on what he was saying. But in my mind, I kept on thinking, this is now a very different film to the one we had half an hour ago.
And give me an idea then of what the before and after was on that. Was it a more Irish-focused, Steve Collins-focused one, and now it had to be a bit more kind of equitable between them?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's it in a nutshell. It's because I think we're used to that, you know. Our first, whenever you make a sports doc, whether it's a team sport or an individual sport or anything, our first port of call, I think, is to look at it through the perspective of the winner. It's just a natural go-to thing. It's why the winners are always interviewed first after a match or after a fight. And, you know, the losers are always kind of the afterthought, the people who are interviewed, because it's the polite thing to do, I suppose. And yeah, I just think it wasn't a conscious decision. I don't think we sat down and thought, this is going to be a Steve Collins film. But I just think that there's a natural tendency towards thinking that way. I mean, you know, I certainly think, you know, the McGuigan-Pedroza film we made, for example, the context to writing that was very much the Barry McGuigan story. And then we kind of managed to track down Pedroza out in Panama City. But, you know, he was a very interesting guy, very intense, but clearly not the performance that we managed to get out of Eubank. And I think that's why the dynamic changed.
You know, you chose this particular fight to make it your Celtic Tiger episode of your trilogy. It is a fight that I suppose, you know, has so many interesting elements to it. Was that something you were aware of from the beginning, or did you, you know, tell me a bit more about discovering what was in there and I suppose, you know, feeling passionately that you wanted to make this?
Well, at the time, I was kind of working on and off in Ireland. I was still based in Wales at that stage. But I remember coming over to the fight. And because when you visit somewhere, and I'd imagine I was coming over at that stage to Dublin once every 2 or 3 months. And I think when you're a regular but not frequent visitor, you see the rate of change somewhere maybe quicker than somebody who's on the ground day in, day out. The changes feel more gradual. But it just seemed that this island was a country, and Dublin certainly was a city, that was changing so dramatically. And these characters, the likes of Noel C. Duggan and Steve Collins and these people, they just seem to somehow personify those changes, this sort of anything goes, anything's possible kind of attitude that seemed to be prevalent at that stage.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's such, and I guess you've got someone like Barry Hearn, who's an incredible talker as well. It feels like everyone that contributes something to this film brings so much to it. So then starting out, so when did you actually begin filming it? And who did you start with? We've mentioned Eubank, but was Steve Collins keen to tell his story? And it feels like he is the main character, if there is one. And he does have to almost, you know, it's a really interesting one because he wins in the end, you know, sorry to give that away. Hopefully people have seen it by now. It's been out for a week, but he wins in the end. But he kind of has to draw attention to the fact that he was the underdog. And that he almost had to, I suppose, make Eubank take him seriously or fear him or whatever it might be. Tell me a bit of the kind of lead up to Collins and understanding what he would be in the film and getting him on board that as well.
I think the key thing with Collins was I remember reading somewhere, and eventually it's a clip that we used in the film, that he felt that he was a complete outsider, and that even though here he was fighting for a world title, his manager was also the manager of the champion, who kind of was also the promoter of this whole Eubank World Tour. So he very much saw himself as the outsider, as this kind of rank underdog who was essentially being paid to turn up to be yet another Eubank opponent as the circus went from town to town in those days. And I just thought that was a really kind of intriguing place to start from, you know, to get into the, to try and get Steve back to that sort of mindset that he was this outsider that nobody cared about at that stage, and how he set about, you know, righting the wrong, really. And, you know, so we kind of started with the forces that drove him. And I think it was really important. I think the first, very rarely does scheduling allow you to do this, but we started, the first two interviews were Collins and Eubank. And I think that was really beneficial, because it then almost allowed us to do this kind of almost spider's web approach where the two lead protagonists were in the can. And then it was a brilliant job, really, on behalf of the producers. I mean, half the cast, I was absolutely amazed that they got them to agree to participate. And so, they started almost in the middle of the web and worked their way outwards along various tentacles. And it was fascinating because the thing about the event itself, and we didn't really want to dilute it by getting into it. I mean, we had to finish the film where it finished. But a lot of the relationships within those characters broke down very badly after the fight. And so the fact that they all agreed to participate 20-odd years later, maybe it is the passing of time. You know, and I've often thought about this in this film, that maybe it was the sweet spot. Maybe had we tried to make this film 15 years ago, I think the wounds and the enmities between some of these characters would have been too deep and too raw, and a lot of them wouldn't have agreed to do it. I think quarter of a century or more later, the doors opened in a way that they certainly wouldn't have, I don't think, a couple of decades ago.
Interesting. And I mean, another person that was kind of a household name at the time is Tony Quinn. And he became such an interesting part of the piece, you know, this almost kind of painted almost as a kind of head shrinking witch doctor in terms of how Chris Eubank received the information anyway. You know, it was almost like, I think he called it black magic at one point. And Tony Quinn was the man who basically was trying to get Steve Collins mentally prepared. He's a guy that we haven't seen on camera very often over the years. So I suppose getting him was, to me, a bit of a coup. It felt like it added so much to the film. It wouldn't have been the same film without him. When you talk about the producers getting people on board, is he someone that you have in mind?
Oh, completely. I mean, you know, he was, as I say, we started the journey with Collins and Eubank, and Tony Quinn was the very last interview we had. And I have to say, I mean, you know, to be fair to the producers on this one, he was very much kind of their project, I think. I mean, maybe there was part of me that was a bit of a sports snob, and I was thinking, you know, come on, guys. I mean, you know, do we really need to go there? And but they were absolutely right. He did add a lot to it, and I suppose whatever anybody thinks of, you know, Tony Quinn and what he does and you know, the businesses he runs or whatever, it doesn't really matter. In terms of the context of the film, I think he did two things. First of all, whatever he did for Steve Collins worked. It was beneficial, you know. Whether it's exactly as described on the tin, I don't know. But there's absolutely no doubt that he was a beneficial presence in terms of Steve Collins. And equally, there's absolutely no doubt that he had a hugely negative impact on Chris Eubank. And so, you know, in the context of that fight, he was a crucial character, and the producers were right and I was wrong.
Wow, that's really interesting. His element of the story, and I totally know where you're coming from the sporting context, it does widen it though, doesn't it? It does kind of bring another element to it that's going to fascinate people who see it. He's very much someone that kind of was almost like a psychologist, as someone that was providing health remedies outside of the mainstream and so on at the time. But he was also a very familiar face, I think, in the Irish consciousness of the time. And one of the things that he brings to the story is I suppose, someone else to talk about Steve Collins' mindset before the fight. Regardless of his own participation, he's someone that spent a lot of time with him. And as well as that, I'm going to ask you, there was some incredible footage of Steve Collins preparing in Las Vegas in a house, you know, trying out these different combinations and so on. That just felt like incredible footage to have. Did that come from Tony Quinn?
It did, yeah. I mean, it was an interesting one. The archive on this mirrored the way that we shot the interviews. You know, certainly with a boxing doc, as you know yourself, you start off with key fights. I mean, you know, clearly those are the essential building blocks, and after that, you know, everything's kind of a bonus to some extent. And a lot of the material that turned up came from personal collections. That material actually came from Steve Collins. They were videos that Steve had in a box. And this project actually made me think about archive quite a lot, because there was such a thrill just to sit in an edit suite. It's fantastic. It's when this stuff arrives and you sit there and you watch this material, which is kind of, you know, the concept that somebody somewhere had captured Tony Quinn walking into a room where Steve Collins is there throwing shapes. I thought, come on, guys, you know, you have me on. But suddenly, you know, you're in the edit suite, and there it is. And I was thinking about this because, you know, I have an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old, and essentially their lives are kind of documented on iPhones. You know, we have videos and photographs and everything. And I was just thinking, in 20 or 30 years' time, you know, long after you and I have hung up our clapperboards, you know, people are going to be doing this job. And the archive record is going to be extraordinary. You know, there's going to be all these thousands of photographs and thousands of hours of video just because people's lives are now documented. And in some ways, I kind of I envy that. I think, how amazing would it be to have all that? But on the other hand, maybe that sudden boost and excitement and adrenaline that comes from unexpected fragments turning up in an edit suite, maybe they won't get that thrill.
Yeah, it's going to be too easy for them, I think, Andrew, you know, when everything is documented. But, you know, throughout your career as a filmmaker, you've made some really wonderful archive films. And I suppose I wonder, do you have any sort of tricks of the trade in terms of tracking stuff down and so on that would be useful to people? Because you don't seem to use a lot of other footage outside of the archive. It's very much use the archive of the time as your storytelling visuals. How do you go about that, I suppose?
I'm not sure if it's tricks. I mean, I think the biggest tip for me would be really to have absolute empathy with whoever it is in any archive house that's had to sit down and log anything, because it's such a thankless task. And, you know, take even the collections of material that's in the IFI, for example. They have hundreds, thousands of hours of stuff, some of it shot by, you know, just people living in towns and villages and cities all over Ireland. And, some archivist has to sort of try and produce a record, be it a digital record or you know, the old-fashioned index cards or whatever. And it's absolutely impossible for anybody to know exactly what's on these things, you know. And so when you're researching for documents, generally word searches, all this sort of stuff, it's much easier. But when you're looking for archive footage or something, there is no substitute for actually having to go in yourself, sit down and just watch everything, because, you know, facial recognition, it's so difficult. I mean, I remember doing a series of three films on the Civil War, and the idea was that we would only use photographs and archive footage from the Civil War itself. And, you know, I remember looking at collections of stuff in London, and some of it would be just labeled Ireland sometime in the 1920s, you know, and 90% of it was just that, you know, it was stuff that had been shot in post 26, 27. But, you know, the other 10% was stuff that was shot during the Civil War. And, you know, without sitting down and just watching it all and just relying on the index cards or the digital records, you wouldn't know.
I mean, it's there's no substitute, I suppose, for sitting down and watching the stuff yourself, because, you know, there could be a sequence of three or five or six shots that are absolutely perfect for what you need and how you think about how you're going to make a scene work that might mean nothing to even an archive researcher that's involved in the project. That's the difficulty of it. You know, you've made a lot of boxing films now at this stage. You were obviously a fan if you were traveling over to fights and so on. Was it that fan element that drew you to making films about it?
Yeah, completely. It was kind of an accident, I suppose. I mean, laced with a sense of delusions of grandeur. I remember a mate and myself had this kind of idea to do. We were both boxing fans, and we thought there was an idea in looking at boxing really as kind of a Celtic story. And it was to do with this idea of emigration to America and Ireland being the first nation in and beginning of boxing in America. But anyway, so this was a six-part series. And that was the reason I was in the Collins Eubank fight, was I was in the middle of writing this series and didn't have an ending. And having seen the press conference, I thought there might just be an ending in this fight. And then you just get sucked in, you know? I mean, it's you're in that world, and those are the stories you're exposed to.
Yeah, and it's funny, you mentioned writing films. So how do you approach a subject like this as a director? Do you write the film in advance of your interviews? Do you do all the interviews and then kind of write what you see as essentially as a script for the film on the basis of that?
I certainly write more now than I used to. And I think part of that was the advent of the BAI Sound and Vision. You know, I think that the degree of sort of preparation and the degree of care you have to take over the treatment and the amount of detail that's required, the fact that you have to have joined up thinking in terms of budgets and how much you've got in there for archive and where that's coming from and all that. It does, I think that has certainly over the last 15 to 20 years, I think I've done a lot more preparation than I would have done beforehand. I think maybe the Chris Eubank interview might signal the end of my writing in advance phase. I don't know. But I would tend to write. I would certainly tend to have beginnings, middles, and ends in mind. And, you know, how I'm going to get there, roughly. I wouldn't really be somebody who's done a huge amount of observational documentary making anyway. So, yeah, in that respect, I think you have to be, you have to write them.
And so is there kind of a prolonged research period then that enables you to kind of feel confident that you know the story inside out?
I think it's a balancing act. I think it's kind of, maybe that's one thing you do kind of learn over the years, is the fact that there's a sweet spot between being underprepared and being overprepared. I think, you know, underprepared is you go out onto the road and you're not well enough briefed or prepared to know really to get the interview done correctly. And overprepared, I think, is when you've gone to the point where there's no flexibility left in taking the film in different directions, having recorded the interviews. And so that, I suppose, is the balancing act.
I think that's a really, really well put, because you don't want to be in the interview and then sort of getting frustrated that the person won't tell you the story the way you think it should be told or anything like that. When you approach filmmaking the way you do, which, as I said, is to really work the archive to tell the story and have a, I think, a certain amount of confidence in the archive and a certain amount of discipline around it. I don't know how you would feel about me saying that, but how does that impact your editing then and your storytelling? Do you feel sometimes that you can't tell the story the way you want to, or that you have to sort of go in the direction that the archive is taking you?
That's really interesting. It's kind of almost trying to find the sane middle ground. I mean, I remember Owen McDonough, myself, you know, Owen and I, he's basically cut almost everything I've done. And he and I did a series together it was about war crimes tribunals. And it was kind of almost setting together a history of war crimes investigations through 8 key cases. And, you know, it's sometimes a trap because it's very difficult. We kind of got all very macho about it. I remember once when we did the Nuremberg trial, not the Nuremberg trials, it was the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem. And, you know, it was almost sort of we took it as a challenge to wade through these hours and hours and hours of footage of, you know, Nazi propaganda, essentially, from the Second World War, to find shots of Eichmann in his uniform. And I mean, that's looking back on it now, it's anal. But I mean, you know, it's we took that too far, probably, because we got about 15 seconds out of it. But I think it's a good discipline nonetheless. I think I do feel that archive is there to be used in a historically accurate way, not as a sort of a general illustrative way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. And I guess I wonder then, for you in those situations, you're using archive and it ends up being then, of course, a lot of archive that you need to use because it's archive filmmaking, essentially. How do you find that as a director? You know, because a lot of the time you would think if you had an unlimited budget, you'd be able to use more of a particular type of archive, but that might be very expensive. It might push you towards using, you know, certain different types of archive, which also do the job, I suppose, but aren't necessarily your first choice, if you know what I'm getting at. So as a director then, obviously the producer is saying to you, we can only do this or we can only do that. Do you have an approach to sort of figuring out how you prioritize what archive you're going to use?
Yeah, I think it's a bit like inviting people to a party. You've got an A list and a B list and a C list, you know, and you know, you start by making sure you got your A listers and that they're affordable and accessible and available, and so that's the base. I mean, again, I think technology comes into this as well. I mean, I wouldn't want to be working that way, you know, in the days before non-linear editing, for example. You know, when those guys, I remember working with editors who cut their teeth literally cutting film. And they would think, you know, us lot, we're just the ill-disciplined generation that keeps changing their minds about things. And, you know, proper filmmakers have a plan, and you know that one shot follows another, and as soon as that film is spliced together, that's the edit. So it is a case of building it up slowly. It is a case of, you know, making sure that you kind of know. I think you get an instinct for the fact that you know that you're going to have to spend 60-70% of your archive budget on that A-list. So that chunk of your budget's gone. But then you know that you've got the key building blocks in place as well. So that's that done. And then you're looking at trying to maintain, or to retain rather, a healthy enough percentage of your archive budget left so that then when, you know, these little unexpected gifts come up halfway during the editing process, you've still got a bit of cash in the kitty to pay for it.
And another thing I suppose you need to keep in mind as well is the scope of the film. So, you know, as you mentioned towards the beginning of this conversation, this is a film that takes place in the Celtic Tiger era. But you don't overly spend time, let's say, explaining what the Celtic Tiger era was or, you know, leaning on news reports from the time, this is very much a this particular story. There is an elements of the backdrop for anyone that's interested, you know, in taking that in. But for you, you know, maintaining this as, I suppose, what's like a well, how's it going to, like a capsule of this particular story, and not allowing in too much from outside. And it's a real strength of the film that you don't get bogged down in too much context, and yet it's there. Is that something that you had in mind, or that you had to work at? Because I feel like you got the balance just right.
Oh, that was one of the few things that was completely set in stone from the beginning. I think that it would have been too easy for us to have, you know, cut to BMW garages and Mercedes garages opening up in Dublin and having, you know, the economics correspondent from the Irish Times turn up and explain to us, you know, what was happening at the time. I think we decided very early on that certainly for an audience that was there, that lived through those times, what we wanted to do was just to evoke that sense of what it was like to live in Ireland in 1995. And, you know, I think that's kind of, that's where that intimacy, that sort of narrowness of focus, I think, helps, because we didn't want the broad landscape here. This was about a very detailed event. And if that helps, you know, as I say, evoke a feeling, or, you know, a sense of nostalgia even, then the film worked.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very interesting that we're seeing a few films begin to come out about that era, the 90s. You know, it's such a transitional time in Irish history and absolutely fascinating. And it's now, as you know, 25 to 30 year period where you can actually look at a time with a little bit of context to understand the social relevance of particular events. So it's kind of interesting that the 90s is starting to have its moment, I think, in terms of films, which I'm definitely in favor of, having grown up in that time. But so now the film's finished. It's going down extraordinarily well, which is fantastic. It absolutely deserves it, and it's such a great watch. How was it received, though, by the people that are in it? And what was the process of showing it to them? At what point did you show it to them, and how did they respond?
That response has been nothing short of miraculous, to be perfectly frank, and way more by luck than judgment, maybe. I don't know. There have been no dissenting voices amongst the cast, which is amazing. In particular, Chris Eubank. He came to a screening in London back in November, December last year, and immediately just was very, very positive about it. And that was very reassuring as well. I mean, I think that, you know, finding the balance without whitewashing the story, that's always kind of, you know, what you aspire to do, I think. And so that was hugely encouraging, because, you know, I felt that if we got the tone right, then everybody's, because the cast were all, we always used to use this phrase that, you know, everybody in this film had to be in the room. So there are no third party interviewees. Everybody was a part of the story. So that made it a little bit easier, because they were talking about themselves, they you know, primarily, or they were talking about their relationship with other protagonists in the story. So, for example, Paul Howard is a boxing writer, but he's in the film because he was writing a book with Steve Collins at the time. So there's a very real context for him being there. And I think by retaining our discipline and making sure that all the contributions from the cast are very much focused on their relationship to either the protagonists or to the event itself, that I think is why the cast has reacted so positively to it.
It's such a nice thing to be able to do when you can just have the film told by the people that were involved. And it's something I think that it's, I think in some small way, it adds so much to the experience of the viewer that when everyone's account is kind of first person and relevant directly to what's happening. I think sometimes once someone is commentating from outside, it can take you out of the story in a strange way that maybe you don't even notice that much. But yeah, you know, Andrew, I think you've done an incredible job. Really delighted for you that it's going down so well. I don't really have any other questions for you other than one that I'm going to start asking everyone, I've decided, which is, if you could give a younger filmmaking Andrew Gallimore a bit of advice, and I'm putting on the spot here, but have you any idea what that might be?
I think at the outset, you know, you have this kind of vision thing and for films and the real excitement about just having the opportunity to make a documentary film. It's such a privilege. And that sense of privilege has never left me. I mean, you know, every time we start a new project, I think, oh my God, you know, they're letting me loose once again. But it's... I think with that came, I think, a sense of almost kind of an intensity maybe of purpose, and which kind of manifested itself maybe in a lack of flexibility in terms of, you know, not letting go of the vision thing, but being kind of able to step back and compromise earlier on in the piece as opposed to thinking, you know, I owe it to myself, to the film, to whatever, to stick with this because this is what we, you know, this is what we want to do. And I just think that the more films I've made, and I think the more I've realized that straying away somewhat from that original vision isn't necessarily a sign of weakness. It's actually probably a sign of strength.
Okay, very well put. Well, Andrew, thanks a million for talking to me. Continued success with the film. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. So I hope it goes down well for you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Andrew for taking part in the interview. One Night on Mill Street is on release in selected Irish cinemas right now. It's great. Go and see it. Thanks to Stephen Galvin and Phil Martin for supporting the podcast, and to film composer Michael Fleming for kindly allowing me to steal his music. You can find more of it at michaelflemingmusic.com. You'll find me on social platforms as Ross Whitaker TV, and of course, thanks to you for listening.